A Message from Leading Into Tomorrow by EY. Dive into our mini-series, Granting the Future, for conversations with public sector leaders revolutionizing grant distribution worldwide. Gain valuable insights into innovative strategies and best practices, and discover how grants are shaping the future of public service delivery. Download the Leading Into Tomorrow podcast series today, available on all major platforms.
Well, thank you very much. They call it Super Tuesday for a reason. This is a big one.
Donald Trump enjoying his victory lap. He didn't quite manage a clean sweep, but the former president looks all but certain to face Joe Biden in November, now that the only other contender for the Republican crown, Nikki Haley, has pulled out.
In all likelihood, Donald Trump will be the Republican nominee when our party convention meets in July. I congratulate him and wish him well.
From Maine to California, Super Tuesday is the bumper date in the primary calendar. A third of the delegates for the Republican and Democrat conventions have now been chosen. As we head into the State of the Union address, the election is shaping up to be an epic grudge rematch of 2020, but with even higher stakes at home and outside America. Welcome to Power Play from Politico, the podcast where we talk to some of the world's most influential people on either side of the Atlantic. I'm Anne McElvoy, this week in Washington, D.C., and hosting two of Politico's finest minds about the state of play in a race for the White House, whose outcomes will shape the choppy oceans of geopolitics in an era of high jeopardy. And we also have a debut for you. John Harris is Politico's very own global editor-in-chief, a veteran of many a primary season and election campaign, and co-founder of Politico. I tried to get John to divulge how many Super Tuesdays he's covered. We might slip that in just a moment, but he did once author a book called The Way to Win, Taking the White House in 2008. So there's a bit of a clue there, isn't there? Hi, John.
I suppose I've been at this a good long time. Been making observations and predictions, which sometimes come true and sometimes don't, for a good long time.
That's exactly what we want on Power Play. And Josh Gerstein, senior legal affairs reporter, Politico's authority on the tangled relationship between politics and the law. And Josh, especially so in a year when the courts and legal rulings are so closely aligned with and often run counter to the political process. Busy one for you.
Yeah, indeed, Anne. I mean, it seems like, you know, at one point we were kind of conceiving of, former President Donald Trump's legal entanglements as kind of a diversion from the 2024 campaign. But it's become clear over the last couple months it's not a diversion, that this is the campaign such as we know it is.
Many of us are trying to become instant legal experts to understand the campaigns better, but then we decided it'd be much better to just get you on the podcast to sort it all out for us. So we'll be coming to that in just a moment. Well, welcome to you both on this post-Super Tuesday edition of Power Play. We're all a bit bleary from watching the results come in. John, what time did you get to bed?
It wasn't that late. I was had hit the pillow by midnight or so.
Admirable self-discipline there. Josh?
I think around the same time, maybe a little later, but I'm not sure it was waiting up for the results.
Well, John, are you surprised at what you did find when your head came back up from that pillow? Are you surprised at the extent of Donald Trump's near clean sweep, and which results stuck out for you?
Sure. Well, and obviously in the near term, not surprised. There was not an enormous amount of suspense. You mentioned I covered a bunch of Super Tuesdays. I've never had one like this where really it isn't that consequential. This is a totally different election year than the ones that I've covered in the past, where the standard rituals, primary nights, inter-party debates for the nomination, those things are typically an enormous deal. And this year, of course, they're not a big deal. It's been clear the trajectory of the race for a long, long time. What is a big deal is the things Josh covers. The primary arenas are not what's going on in the Iowa caucuses or what consultant is about to get hired or fired. The primary arenas in this contest are the legal arenas, the courtrooms, what's happening in civil and criminal courts, and ultimately what's going to happen in the Supreme Court. That's replaced the primary process.
To turn to Josh in just a minute on that fallout from that attempt in Colorado to have Donald Trump removed from the ballot and what might follow from that. But John, just to stay with you on one thought, we saw Nikki Haley notch up
win in Vermont, denying Donald Trump a clean sweep. I don't know if you think that's that would be particularly annoying to him, but she then went on to pull out of the race. But she hasn't, at least as far as I know, as we sit down here, endorsed Trump. Can you just read for us what Nikki Haley does next out of this situation?
That's really the decisive question, is whether she keeps the voice that she tried to raise in this contest. It's a voice of warning. Donald Trump is a potentially a long-term disaster for Republicans. It's a voice of disdain. She clearly stands in opposition to him. What she stands for is a version of the Republican Party that has been routed in this primary season. Really, it's a six-year rout that's been going on. The establishment wing of the Republican Party, the traditional pillars of business, social conservatives that define the Republican Party for really all the decades I've been covering politics, those are shattered. Does she still try to be the voice for those, or does she step in line and say, well, I tried my best. I took a pledge when I got in to support the nominee, and so that's what I'm going to do. That's really what we're going to be watching. I think it's a pretty significant decision on her part because you can look at the polling, Ann, and see that a lot of people who are unenthusiastic about President Joe Biden really have misgivings about voting for Donald Trump. They were hoping, not in the face of a lot of evidence, they were hoping that her campaign would take off. The fact that it didn't means, where do they go? What do they do?
And quick one on Joe Biden. Had a pretty good night, didn't he? He won his contest in 15 states. There's always a fly in the ointment, and this time it was losing it to a local businessman called Jason Palmer in American Samoa by 11 votes. Something went wrong in the ground operation there, people. But what do you take more broadly? I guess he could live without the president.
Well, we were talking last night, who in the newsroom gets to go on a trip to American Samoa and check out the reasons for that surprise upset. Perhaps that will be a good place for the next power play. You can go live from the beaches of the South Pacific.
It's great. And I got the budget signed off there live on air. You heard it all, listeners. I'm up for that. Quickly on what it means for Joe Biden.
What it means is that he's got the Democratic Party in his grip to the same extent that Donald Trump has the Republican Party in his grip. In his grip does not mean with enthusiasm. You can see it in virtually every poll. Even Democrats are raising questions about whether President Joe Biden really should have sought re-election. They're expressing their dissatisfaction with the choices. Really, this is an election that's going to be about Donald Trump from beginning to end. Joe Biden's strategy, it's now clear, and this is going to be underlined, I'm sure, in the State of the Union later this week. His strategy is also all about Trump. That's the only way that President Biden could win a second term, I believe, is by making the choice of seem so unpalatable to enough Americans. So on both sides of this election that's now, it's very clear the shape of it, it's all about Trump.
Here we are again. So, Josh, earlier this week, the big story that you and your team were taking apart, of course, was that Supreme Court case which ruled unanimously against Colorado's attempt to remove Trump from the ballot, and that's emboldened the former president. Was it a mistake of Colorado and some other states to pursue this legal route, a kind of long shot that was more likely to make a man who likes to be both a titan and a martyr into a martyr?
Well, I mean, in most states, the officials involved didn't have a lot of choice. The one that actually wound up at the Supreme Court was brought by a group of voters in Colorado, and they're the ones who essentially brought the matter to the Colorado court, said Trump was disqualified because of his role in the events of January 6, 2021, the Capitol riot, and his broader efforts to undermine and overturn the results of the 2020 election. And they brought this up through the system. And at that point, the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, after the Colorado Supreme Court concurred that he was disqualified, sort of had no choice but to get involved to head off what was, in the view of many, potential chaos across the country. You would have had Trump being struck from possibly some primary ballots, although they actually didn't move fast enough to do it in Colorado or these Super Tuesday races that we're discussing now. And then, of course, you would have had states knocking him off of the general election ballot as well. And, you know, that's something clearly that the U.S. Supreme Court found unpalatable. And while you're right, Ann, it was a unanimous ruling in the sense that all the justices agreed that what Colorado did here was not permitted. then basically ordered Trump restored to the ballot. There were some pretty sharp disagreements among the justices about some of the details, and they were not by any means unanimous on that part.
John, what do you make of that in terms of the fallout from this decision, perhaps not only for Donald Trump, but for that role of the court as we go deep into the election year?
To me, it sharpened something that I think has been clear for a while. People who oppose former President Trump, who are concerned about him, Democrats and lots of people who don't identify as Democrats, they often portray this election as a battle for democracy. Democracy itself is at stake. If that's the case, the only way to vindicate democracy is by winning an election and beating Donald Trump at the polls. There is no legal avenue that is likely, in my judgment, to be the decisive conflict with the Trump
movement.
Do
you mean practically, or do you mean that this is the way you read it as a political journalist?
Really, in both senses. I'm really meaning the point more broadly, though. Trump is, and I think Super Tuesday underlines this, he may be a threat to democracy, but he is also an expression of democracy. This makes clear that he is a powerful movement. Most people thought after January 6th, after losing an election in 2020, after leading to his party to broad defeats in the midterm elections of 2018, Trump is gone. The Republican Party is going to move on. We're done with him. And what could be more obvious? That's what I thought, incidentally, and even wrote. What could be more obvious over the past year is that he isn't command of this party. He has not just the sort of grudging tolerance of the party the way President Biden does. He has the affirmative enthusiasm of it. He is a political movement. The only way to defeat a political movement is by building a larger one.
Josh, is that your kind of default mode here as well? Or do you take a slightly different view because you're so steeped into looking at these legal challenges? We also have Georgia coming up, which is a case, I think, where there's a bit of perhaps more of a majority view that could be the one that was more challenging to him. Is that something that you share?
Well, I mean, what's fascinating about this, Anne, is, you know, you were asking me earlier about whether it was a mistake to have brought the challenges to knock Trump off the ballot. I think the same question can be asked about any of the four criminal cases that he is facing. You know, they have had this perverse effect, right? They've had the effect that, you know, by charging Trump with, 91 different felony offenses, that has rallied his base. It's led to this sort of sense that he's a martyr. There's an element of jujitsu here where he's been able to, convert that attempted blow against him into really reinforcing his effort to take out the rest of the Republican field. And so, you know, so far, he's been quite talented and skilled at that. We've even seen him trying to capitalize on the cases in the last couple months as media opportunities for him to go in front of cameras and, you know, re-emphasize to his base voters and, frankly, even some Republicans that he's being unfairly persecuted, you know, and he's been showing up at court hearings where his presence is not required, right? He's out there complaining that he's being forced off the campaign trail by a bunch of political vendettas, you know, brought in the legal system. And then he shows up at hearings where he doesn't need to be there. So that indicates to you the degree to which, you know, he and his campaign aides have decided that, for better or worse, as we discussed at the very beginning, this campaign is being fought out in the courtroom, and he might as well join the battle there rather than strictly whining about it somewhere else. And he's now doing his damnedest to do that.
The courts end up being a great vehicle to practice Trump-style politics. That politics rests on what I've called the contempt paradox. That is, the more President Trump, former President Trump, offends establishment sensibilities, the more the New York Times says that he's breaking every norm, or the New York Times says that he's a liar, the more that Chuck Schumer or Nancy Pelosi is revolted by him and makes that plain, the more his own support is stimulated. People look at President Trump, his opponents, many of them with contempt, and that actually is a great stimulant for the contempt on the other side. So our politics is broadly defined by contempt, and it turns out that the courts are a great venue for Trump to be practicing his brand of contempt politics.
There's a bit of a challenge to that, though, isn't there? It might look like that now, and it'd be interesting what Josh thinks about this, because we're looking
nothing really much to the extremes of the argument. You know, people who want to get him off the ballot or people who absolutely will die at the stake to keep him on the ballot. But I suppose where the contempt paradox might have a question mark over it is what then happens when you go out to undecided voters? What happens when it gets down as the year goes on towards those states that decide the election? Do you still believe that that rule holds, that in a way, the worse the better, to take the old Lenin saying for Donald Trump? Or do you think then there are people who will say, eek, this is just all going a bit too far for me?
I mean, that's the essential question. I think it's inconceivable that President Biden will win a second term unless the bulk of those undecideds go to him. Recall that in 2020, that election, just like this one, was all about Trump. He increased his vote total, and people forget that. He increased his vote total between from 2016 to 2020. At the same time, he increased the Democratic vote total even more. Who thinks that that vote total, it was a record in American history. But that total for Joe Biden was stimulated primarily by enthusiasm for Joe Biden. Of course it was not. It was stimulated by contempt for Donald Trump.
What about you, Josh? Are you as convinced by that, that from what you're seeing and when you see, when you travel around and you go to places where these rulings are being made, is that the vibe that you're getting, the same as John sitting here with us, or do you see it a little differently?
Well, I guess I see it a little bit differently, which is I totally agree with John about this contempt paradox. I think this is part of why the media's fact-checking efforts directed at Trump, say back in 2016, were so spectacularly unsuccessful, because every time the media called him a liar, it actually built his support. And I think what these cases that have been brought against him have the potential to bring into the public domain and really draw attention to, the question is, can they get any of these four criminal cases to trial? It looks like one in New York will be going to trial later this month. However, most Democrats regard that as the least politically damaging case of the four that Trump is facing. And so it has become this kind of race to see which of these cases can be put in front of a jury, which will mean airing some of the things that Trump did. And right now, the actions by the Supreme Court have left those questions in limbo. And the most significant cases, the ones about him trying to overturn the 2020 election, the ones about him hoarding classified documents and refusing to give them back, can they get in front of a jury between now and November? And I wish I could give you a definitive answer. All I can tell you is that most of the people who are opponents of Trump in the legal world that I speak to are not optimistic about these cases being brought to trial before November, with the exception of this so-called hush money case that it looks like will go to trial in Manhattan in a few weeks.
So briefly, John, there, that could be the limit or the cliff edge of your contempt paradox. But according to what Josh is saying, it probably wouldn't kick in maybe fully till after the election anyway.
If there's a question of timing. And then I would also agree with you. I think what you're saying is that if there was a conviction, doesn't that change the character of the politics? And I think it's entirely possible that it does. I don't think it's inevitable that it does, given President Trump's history in the past. But it's certainly possible that it does. But as Josh points out, we don't have any particular reason for confidence that on the most consequential criminal cases that we're going to get them before the election. If Donald Trump were to win a second term in that election, what would happen to those cases is a total open question mark.
Josh, you've written this week that there was an underappreciated implication of that Colorado ruling that we started this section talking about. And you said this, and it stuck in my mind because it's so extraordinary. It could open the path to another January the 6th crisis 4 years after the attack on the Capitol. And I suppose a lot of us, and this will be true for people listening outside America, think that the reason we're in a lot of this legal entanglement is in some way kind of philosophically to kind of prevent that happening again. But you seem to be suggesting the door was open to it. How so?
Well, the reason, Anne, is, you know, what the Supreme Court was effectively doing in that decision was interpreting the portion of the Constitution of the 14th Amendment that says that insurrectionists are barred from serving in public office at any level. And the question was, who gets to enforce that? I think the answer has to be someone gets to enforce that. Otherwise, the provision has no effect whatsoever and seems meaningless. And the answer the Supreme Court came upon in this case, obviously to push aside the Colorado state's action, state court's action, was that Congress is the one that has to determine how that provision is going to be enforced. And so they effectively punted this ball into Congress's court, where many people expect, of course, they're not going to pass legislation in the next few months that would, you know, effectively deny Donald Trump access to the ballot or even set up a procedure to do that. But in punting the issue to Congress, they did seem to add weight to the argument that Congress is the body that has the authority to enforce this provision, and maybe legislation isn't the only way they could do it. For example, historically, we know that the House and Senate have had debates, at least, and in some cases actually have refused to seat members that they consider to be insurrectionists. So clearly they have some authority outside of legislation to enforce this provision against insurrectionists. And one question that I do think was left on the table by the Supreme Court ruling was, you know, if we had another contested, closely contested election, as we did in January 6th, where people wanted to make objections to the tallies of electoral votes, might you have Democrats, if it looked like Donald Trump had narrowly won the Electoral College, come in and again try to argue that he is disqualified by virtue of his involvement in, you know, what many view as an insurrection 4 years earlier? You know, do I think a lot of Democratic lawmakers would try to make that argument in the context of tallying the electoral votes? Probably not. Might enough of them feel compelled because of their own party dynamics to try to make that argument, to make a big mess of the tallying of the electoral votes in 2025? I think it could be a big mess. And a lot of people therefore think the Supreme Court could have done a clearer job of indicating that that particular avenue is no longer open for debate.
Well, we'll be back in just a moment to look into what comes next, and particularly the State of the Union speech. So stay with us.
A message from Leading Into Tomorrow by EY. Dive into our miniseries, Granting the Future, which explores how governments and organizations distribute trillions of dollars in grants to tackle urgent international challenges and deliver on domestic priorities. Join us for inspiring conversations with public sector leaders who are revolutionizing grant distribution worldwide by using technology to navigate complex environments and optimize outcomes. Gain valuable insights into innovative strategies and best practices, and discover how grants are shaping the future of public service delivery. Download the Leading Into Tomorrow podcast series today, available on all major platforms. Join us in shaping the future of public service delivery. Your journey into innovation and impact starts now.
John, President Biden will deliver the State of the Union address on Thursday. He's likely to have no bigger single opportunity to command the attention of the American public ahead of November's election on his own terms. How does he use this moment?
There aren't that many rituals left in American politics where you can command the attention of the entire country or a big chunk of it at one time. The State of the Union seems to be still one of those moments where people do pay attention to what a president says of either party. And many presidents have used this venue quite effectively in election years to frame the terms of the contest. I think that's a tall order for President Biden, who is not especially skilled at using the public platform of the presidency, of making it primarily an educational office or a platform from which to wage a national argument. That's just not historically where he has been strong. I do think people will be looking at the State of the Union to see how vigorous President Biden seems, since the polls make unmistakably clear that concerns about his age and his physical vigor and potential mental acuity, those are very real. He's got to answer those. And even though it's not his natural venue, it is an occasion to talk for an hour. In some cases, presidents go well beyond an hour about specific policy objectives. And it's a great chance for him to draw this contrast. This is where I would take the country. And I'm sure he's going to paint a very draconian picture of where this is where former President Trump would take the country.
Josh, did you largely agree with what you were hearing there from John about how this State of the Union address would be approached? And does the sort of legal quagmire figure in it, or perhaps less so?
Biden has been very careful to try to stay away from any of the details of the legal quagmire that Trump is in. You know, he has on occasion made kind of offhand comments that, you know, he does believe that Trump tried to steal the 2020 election and that he engaged in insurrection. But he's also tried very hard to stay out of the way of the Justice Department and the others who are prosecuting Trump, just due to the obvious conflict of interest. Indeed, in some of the cases, there are even comparisons that people have made to things that Biden has done. I'm talking less about the democracy cases and more about the issue of the classified documents. So for a variety of reasons, he's tried to steer clear of that. I think that John is right. We'll hear something more akin to a rule of law kind of argument that is not explicitly anti-Trump, but just implicitly anti-Trump.
Let's look at the key campaign issues. And John, it's striking when you look under the hood that Trump is commanding poll leads. They're collated by Doug Sosnick in the New York Times and the Journal and reported in our playbook in detail this week, where he really does seem to have some quite big advantageous areas there, securing the border, Trump at plus 25 points, having the necessary wherewithal, mental, physical, to be president, Trump plus 23, dealing with the economy, plus 22, and dealing with crime, I think, as you might expect. That's pretty much a good slate for Trump. Is there anything kind of wrong with this analysis?
Well, on the merits, you wouldn't have a hard time getting plenty of people to come on your show and explain point by point why that is substantively wrong. I think the data that Doug Sosnick compiled, and of course he's somebody Josh and I know, we go way back. He was originally one of Bill Clinton's chief political advisors. I think he's on to something there, which is many people do broadly regard President Trump as a strong figure. They may find him strongly objectionable. His supporters like this impression of strength. You know, I myself as a journalist would say, well, the perception of strength, let's look at the actual record of achievement. You know, the former president goes up against the current president, as we all expect will happen in the fall. It will be a contest of perceived strength. And so the fact that many voters regard President Biden as infirm, that's a big, big issue. And for now, the polling that you cited, I think, is something significant. They did see former President Trump as strong on the economy, strong on the border, strong on crime.
John, we're living in particularly choppy times, national security and foreign policy. What's the risk then for Joe Biden that he could alienate groups of voters because of his strong support for Israel in Gaza? No secret, I think, that the White House has become rather frustrated with Israel's leadership in certain aspects of its conduct there in the war in Gaza. Just for me, coming back into Washington after a few months and seeing all those ceasefire now posters sprinkled around those certainly Democrat neighborhoods, but not, you would say, only the Bernie Sanders or only the sort of hard left constituency. This does seem to be an issue that is causing difficulty there for the Democrats.
I do think something profound is going on, particularly in the politics of the left in the United States and other countries regarding Israel and support for Israel. I think 25 or more years of a Netanyahu government, most of the time, he's the dominant figure for the past generation in Israeli politics, has left profound consequences in terms of progressive support for the state of Israel.
We can't let you both go without putting you through the last exam question everyone gets comes on this podcast. Who would you listen to if we booked them for Power Play? And indeed, you should come back and help me interview them when they're the right guest that you'd like to be hearing from. So, Josh, like, what's going to get you out of bed and say, everyone in my family and friendship group has got to listen to this amazing podcast, she said modestly.
Well, in my thinking about things in my arena, it's sort of a behind-the-scenes figure who actually once worked in the same building where Politico's Washington offices are located, a fellow named Boris Epstein, who is sort of the guy behind the curtain for everything Trump is doing on all of his legal entanglements and challenges. You know, he rarely shows up in court. He doesn't talk much publicly anymore, although at one time he was a TV commentator, and for a few weeks, I think he worked in the Trump White House. It would be interesting to see how he is acting as the maestro of Trump's legal defense, because it is at this point a very complicated symphony that he is trying to play in the middle of this presidential campaign.
He sounds like an amazing guest who never actually says anything. But hey, if anybody can get him to come on the show, Josh, it's going to be you. And what about John?
Well, and Josh and I go so far back, all the way back to the Clinton years. It's got me in a Bill Clinton state of mind. Wouldn't he be a great commentator if we can get him off the sidelines and sharing what he really thinks in an unvarnished way here on Power Play?
Former President Bill Clinton, you have your invitation from John Harris and from me. Thank you to both our stellar guests today. John, back to it, back to the desk.
Thanks so much, Anne.
And Josh.
Thank you, Anne. Great to be here.
Well, that's all for this week's edition of Power Play. Next week, I'm headed to Florida to talk to Miami Mayor Francis Suarez, one of the big guns in the Republican Party, about what he makes of the 2024 race. If you want to get all of our episodes immediately they're published, please go ahead, follow Power Play wherever you're listening. We're available on all major podcast platforms. And the team behind Power Play and this grateful host enjoys seeing your ratings and reviews. Please keep them coming. We learn a lot from what you tell us. The senior producer is Peter Snowden, the executive producer, Christina Gonzalez. And this week, thanks too to Annie Rees, managing producer of podcasts in Washington, D.C. See you soon.
Today's episode is presented by Leading Into Tomorrow by EY. Dive into our mini-series, Granting the Future, for conversations with public sector leaders revolutionizing grant distribution worldwide. Gain valuable insights into innovative strategies and best practices, and discover how grants are shaping the future of public service delivery. Download the Leading Into Tomorrow podcast series today, available on all major platforms.